Okay, Lucky Bunny is the story of Queenie Dove, who's born in London in 1933 into a criminal family. So she's sort of a contemporary Moll Flanders figure, and it follows her life right up to the 60s, all through some major crime events in London, which Queenie is a major player in. And the bit I'm going to read is from a period in her life where she's trained up by some women thieves called the Ten Green Bottles. And she's just a little girl, she's lost her nan, we're in London, and it's just after the war. And the one who makes the biggest impression on Queenie is a woman called Gloria. And this is Queenie narrating. It's Gloria who's the boldest and the best, the one I want to be like. This one day, we were walking along Bond Street and she says, how about some cucumber sandwiches and a spot of chocolate cake in the Dorchester? Just you and me. After the trip to see Mum last summer, I know she looks out for me somehow. She says it's her job to teach me, as I don't have another woman to do it. Annie is as big as a house now and not coming out with us so much now the baby's nearly due. I haven't heard of the Dorchester, but she takes my silence as a yes and hails us a cab. I watch closely how she does this. She doesn't wave her arm or shout like Annie or Beatty. She just steps a little closer to the curb and tilts her chin. It's a nippy little movement. She stares down the first cab driver who approaches, and then it's just a flicker of her white glove and the cab stops and we're climbing inside. She pats the seat beside her and sort of purrs at the driver. Park lane, please, the Dorchester. We all like it best up the West End. We're sick of roped off streets with signs about unexploded bombs and pubs like the Nag's Head on Whitechapel Road saying business as usual, but where the building is flapping open and hanging on by a thread. In the West End, there are tiny purple flowers spilling out of window boxes and post boxes and telephone boxes gleaming with new paint. As a taxi slides past, I squint a little, making the streets blur into soft putty colours with bright splashes of tomato red. But as we get out and the doorman in his big hat sweeps us in, my mouth feels dry. The height of the ceiling threatens me, dangling the most dangerous looking chandeliers over us. Gloria smooths a hand over my hair and smiles at a fixed spot over my head, heading for the cloakroom. She hands over her coat, a dark velvet, one she calls tidy, but not her best. And as we wait there, a fat, powdered lady arrives. Gloria steps back and says, oh, after you, my dear. And the lady hands her coat to the girl behind the desk, who gives her a button for it, with 26 on it in black numbers. It's a floor sweeping, silky sable fur, and I see Gloria glance at it. I register her look. I wonder just how out of the blue this little trip was, really. Bending a little, Gloria whispers, fat slug. She then straightens up and allows one of the waiters to show us to a table. We walk past the marble columns, the promenade bar, Gloria says, safest place in London during the war. She tells me Churchill had his own suite here. Everywhere is green and gold, full of fronds and gigantic sprays of flowers. Instead of fountains and streams, there's bubbling chatter and the sound of cutlery, chinking and crockery clinking. It's just so big. High ceilings loom over us, and I almost stumble into a statue of a boy holding some golden fruit next to a golden lamp. As we sit down, Gloria notices that I'm trembling. The waiter is hovering, staring right through me. Relax, Queenie, Gloria whispers. She picks up the menu and flaps herself with it. My niece and I would like afternoon tea, please, she says. He dips in a sort of bow, picks up our menus and leaves us. Gloria leans in close towards me and mutters, just speak in your Margaret Lockwood voice. When I say nothing, she gets out her compact and uses the mirror to see who's sitting behind her. Then she takes the green velvet cushion I'm holding like a shield and puts it firmly on the seat beside me. You know, she says, I used to work here. Did you? I can hardly believe it. Here among the tinkling silver and the sparkling mirrors and the golden fruit and, yeah, I was a chambermaid. Look, Queenie, we've earned this. When you've wiped round the bath of one of those fat slugs for the umpteenth time, you get to enjoy sipping from the best bone china, okay? The waiter reappears with a silver tray. He places a cup close to me, and a little silver tea strainer in its own silver pot. Seeing my hand shake as I go to pick up the spoon, Gloria waits for him to leave and then whispers, "He's just a waiter, a waiter. His mum works as a cleaner down the Troxy on Commercial Road. And yet to me, he seems like the poshest, scariest representative of another world I've ever come across." I look again at Gloria, grateful, and take a bite of the triangle of crustless cucumber sandwich she offers me. "No vinegar?" I ask, which makes her laugh for some reason. I risk a glimpse around. The restaurant area is full of women, all of them drinking tea and talking. I'm struck by how much they use their hands when they talk, these posh women. That's all I can see. Hands. Flapping, waving, wagging, clutching, grasping among the hothouse fronds. Their hands look like birds to me, dipping, spreading, soaring, a restaurant full of birds pecking over their crumbs, sipping at their tea. And the chink of china sounding like coins in a pocket, jangling. Gloria sees me looking and leans in to whisper, "Most of this lot were brasses. Don't half give themselves airs. They married their client, that's all. Me, I cut out the middleman and made money, my husband. Which, if you think about it, is much nicer." At the cloakroom, Gloria is all charm and innocence, as she seems to have lost the button with the number on it that allows her to collect her coat. I say nothing, and the room swarms. I'm small and then big, my face on the outside of a kettle, a silver spoon. "Oh dear, what was my number again, darling?" Gloria twinkles. 26, I reply, without missing a beat. The fur is brought, the sable fur, the fat slug's coat, long, a gorgeous colour. Gloria looks a knockout in it. She slides her arms into the sleeves, strokes the collar up to her neck, as if she's petting a big, sleepy cat, and gives the girl behind the desk a cheeky smile. "Thank you so much, darling." She does a little twirl in the coat, almost giving the game away. She's so delighted. And Gloria turns and stalks through the doors as if she's a big cat herself. I'm 2 paces away. I'm right behind her.
Hi, Jill. Congratulations, hi. First of all, on being selected for the 2012 Fiction Uncovered.
Thank you.
Are you happy?
I'm very happy. I couldn't be happier about it.
Have you heard of the prize before?
I have. I was aware of it last year. I think I noticed some of the names. Tim Pierce springs to mind. Right, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you for the reading, and thank you for writing Lucky Bunny. It was one of my finds of the judging process. It was really good. I've got some questions. There's a strong historical theme in your fiction. What are the benefits and pitfalls of setting your books in the past?
I think I'll deal with the benefits first. Obviously, yeah. I do often choose to do that. There's something for me imaginatively that happens when it's not set in a contemporary world that I know. I mean, the minute I have to go to the 50s in Soho, or the 20s actually in Ilford, which is another period I've written about, my imagination sort of works over time. I think there's something for me to do with the research, the reading, looking at images, just thinking about different eras. Seems to produce stories that I'm much more attracted to. There's something about, it's not that, I mean, I'm doing contemporary novel right now, so it's not as if I avoid the present day. I have written about it. It's not so fertile quite for the imagination.
Yeah. And the downside, would you say there was one? Do you have obsessive fans that say, well, you haven't, it's not quite right, the bomb didn't fall on this?
Yes, that is the downside. Always the anxiety about getting things wrong or getting things wrong, both. And also obsessive researching and fact-checking. I do remember in The Great Lover, one of the copy editor's comments was, "A cat on Hampstead Heath, I've never seen one." And actually that's in Rupert Brooke's diary entry. He mentions it, so there could have been a cat. You know, but you become really obsessed with getting it right.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you want to be as factually honest as possible, don't you?
Yeah.
You talked about the research process. Do you enjoy that side of it? Do you enjoy inhabiting that time frame?
Yes, I mean, that's the bit I love. I didn't do an English degree. I did American studies, which involved history, literature, art, film, politics. So it was a range of subjects. And I think that setting something in the past allows me to sort of dip into different areas. And I might end up obsessively reading about sort of law to do with the death penalty, let's say, or sort of permits a kind of obsession which most writers probably suffer from, to really be indulged.
Yeah.
There is a downside, which is you can't put all of it in, and you mustn't put all of it in.
Yeah.
So you have to jettison a lot of the research. But
so you are you a method researcher, like a method actor? You're a method writer? Do you start dressing in 50s outfits? And
maybe there's a little bit of that in me. I think I am, in the sense that to me it isn't always books about or other people's perceptions of the era.
Mm.
It's very much about going to places.
Mm.
So for example, for the Soho scenes in here, I often did walk around the area and try to imagine which aspects would have been the same,
mm.
whether the smells of the market would still be there, whether
yeah.
a shop was a barber's back then. It's often about walking the walk and going to places. I try to resist the temptation to read endlessly other accounts by contemporary writers.
Yeah.
I think you want to go back to the time as well,
yeah.
if you can.
Lucky Bunny, you described as a crime novel, but the narrative deals with issues of domestic violence, abuse, homosexuality, and the hardship of post-war years. Is it difficult to balance the pace of a crime novel whilst being sensitive to those themes?
Yes, it is. I think that how I think of it actually is something of a sort of rogue memoir. It's like a kind of fake, like Moll Flanders or something,
mm.
a sort of this is my account, only mm. we know it isn't true.
Yeah.
And we know it isn't true for a number of reasons, because she's sort of a born liar and she admits it and
mm.
she does embellish and exaggerate. So I think in that way I was working with the idea that I could keep up the pace, because
mm.
Queenie herself is quite a storyteller.
Yeah, yeah.
And she would concentrate on all the exciting episodes and the sort of jewellery heists or the sexy bits. But that what I hoped was that the reader would pick up underneath a sort of another story, which is the hardship,
mm.
the violence, the frightening moments, the poverty. And that despite what she says about being lucky and it all being glamour and fun,
mm.
there is absolutely a sort of second story running underneath, and mm. that was kind of the challenge for this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that from reading it, dealing that quite a lot of novels, contemporary novels, are written where they're kind of very issue based, and that's they kind of get overwhelmed by that. But you were able to deal with a kind of range of themes with a kind of a lightness of touch, but also had the depth there, which was
good.
Which was really
thank you. Well, I think primarily I want to tell
there,
a story. No, I do. You know what I mean? It's not a sort of, I never think that preaching to people or trying mm. to get a message across is ever an enjoyable experience for a reader. They want to be kind of captivated, lost in a world,
mm.
carried along, and then perhaps think about it later. That would be my aim, that if you create a convincing character, it will stay with people and
yeah.
they'll be thinking about it.
Yeah. Queenie has we've brushed on this already, but Queenie has a very strong voice, but the reader is never quite sure she's telling the whole truth. Do you enjoy unsettling your readers
mm.
in that way, toying with their emotions?
Do you make it sound a bit bad put like that? I do. I mean, I love the idea of an unreliable narrator,
mm.
but I would say that we all are. I think that my sort of point there is that everyone creates their life or creates a narrative of their life in a particular way, tells
yeah.
their own story. And towards the end of the novel, she even pointedly remarks on that in a discussion with her friend Stella, that really you do make up your past or how you see things very much to suit your own purposes. So in that, I don't think Queenie's unique. But the thing that was very deliberate was I was also looking at an alternative history of crime in London
mm.
during that time, and
yeah.
it's very, very male, as we all know. It's all
yeah.
the Cray twins and the great train robbers, and there's not much about the women. So Queenie, or I should say me,
mm.
but it's sort of a device to also tell another story
mm.
of what was the women's role
yeah.
and to put her at the centre of things. And in a way, she forces that. She's very sassy and she has an ego and she's determined to be at the centre. And that's part of her unreliableness too.
Was there a person or a group? One of the questions I've got is there a gang that that this is based upon, or obviously
there's
a group?
There was a gang. They were called the 40 Elephants, and they were based in South London. Why
okay.
they were called the 40 Elephants was they stuffed all the clothes down their pants and all the rest of it and came out looking really big,
yeah.
which is described in the novel.
Yeah.
And they occurred in various accounts and were mentioned. And one of them was a sister of a famous gangster. But it was hard to get info, naturally
mm.
enough. So the 10 green bottles are a made up
yeah.
a sort of group of women, but based on that idea that such women did work in gangs in the days when security was very light
mm.
in new department stores, and it was possible to go shoplifting on an enormous scale and
yeah.
not be found out, it seems.
The passage that you wrote, or that you read from, that was in the Dorchester. Did you do any reconnaissance into the Dorchester?
I did, of course. And I mean, that was fascinating too. This aspects which remain always intrigue me. So what I'll do is take a notebook and say the image of the women sort of talking in their hands. That was very much what I noticed and had never noticed. I had never looked at a group of women in that sort of dispassionate, observing way and seen that they're just, it's like flocks of birds.
Yeah.
And so in that respect, you make a connection because it seems to me that could have been the case then and is the case now.
Yeah.
And then simple, straightforward things like what were the, you know, what was the decor like? Was the promenade bar there? That kind of thing. Mm. I would sort of make a note and then check. But probably I'm more obsessed than most readers would be, so I hope I get away with things, really.
I think the assurance that comes through is that you sound like you know what you the research is done, and you're very evocative of the... You can kind of visualise it really easily.
Well, that's what I would hope for, persuade them.
For all the hardships that in the novel, there is also great humour. Do you enjoy making people laugh?
Do you know, that's a funny one. I never deliberately set out to make people laugh. And quite often the first person to read my novels is my husband. Mm. And he often will laugh at scenes or... Mm. And so I suppose when that happens is quite often if I've captured a character maybe that's recognisable. Yeah. So someone like Gloria, who's larger than life and is a sort of composite figure, but a bit of a sort of Diana Dawes and very sassy... Mm. I think the humour is often in the people and the things that they say. It's not a deliberate... in fact, if it happens at all, I'm very pleased, but I'm not aware of it.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Is Lucky Bunny lucky?
Mm. Well, there's lots of strands here to this idea of luck, and one of them is that she's given the Lucky Bunny as a baby.
Yeah.
And for Queenie, there's no doubt that this is the beginning of her life of glamour because it's a lovely little white Lucky Bunny and it's brought by her father. It's obviously nicked.
Yeah.
I think a reader could see the irony in that.
Yeah.
But also, they could perhaps see the irony in confusing things with love. I mean, Queenie goes on a lifelong pursuit of things, stolen things, jewellery, diamonds, furs, and doesn't really understand, because she's never received, you know, love, care, attention. And I think in that respect, it's not a lucky start.
Mm.
But whether she is or isn't, I quite like the reader to have their own opinion. I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
You know, I love the sort of idea that if a novel feels believable, we invest an awful lot and start to make our own minds up. That's what I always hope for.
Yeah. Okay. A kind of slightly more general question, which is... and carries on from a theme about the historical theme. If you could live in any historical period, when would it have been?
Well, that's a good one. I do love the 50s, having researched it, but only, I think, in terms of superficial things like the fashions. I mean, not necessarily, you know, the politics or... No. I think that's quite a tough one. I'm pretty happy with... The 21st century, actually, and I think it's a very tough one. Things for women in particular were very hard. I mean, the reason I balked about the 50s, thinking about it, you know, contraception for women was non-existent.
No.
So having a life, you know, a sort of sex life, a love life, the way men could was impossible.
Yeah.
So in many ways, it was very difficult for women. So I think we're quite lucky in lots of respects.
With regards to other writers currently writing, is there one more? Not necessarily having to be fiction, but do you not read while you're in the process of writing?
Fiction? I often reread something that I love because I find that very more restful than a new novel. It's as if you can just get lost in it. It's familiar.
Who's your favourite contemporary author or...?
My favourite contemporary one, I'm afraid he's not contemporary anymore, he's dead, which is the writer Richard Yates, but he didn't die that long ago, I think it was the 80s.
Mm.
And I've reread Revolutionary Road, which everyone knows, but also lots of his earlier novels. And I find a sort of rationed lyricism very tender and poignant.
Mm.
And it's very, very masculine, obviously. He's always writing about sort of male lives and failed relationships and alcoholism and breakdown, all of which I think he experienced. But he's very good at the women.
Yeah.
So I think that's an odd choice for me, but it's one I love. And I think it's because he's technically exquisite. I mean, right down to the last semicolon, there's never anything out of place in a Richard Yates novel. He was an obsessive. So I've got very obsessed with him. And I've also loved Hilary Mantel, Toni Morrison. I mean, yes, I read a lot of fiction, as most writers do.
Do you find that there is a lack of good, this is a relatively stock question, but a very strong female character, obviously, in Lucky Bunny. Do you find that there's still a dearth, or that publishers try to push female writers to write certain female characters?
I think there's a lack of a character like Queenie Dove, definitely, which is why I wanted to create her. So that would be a kind of sassy, loudmouth, you know, kind of compelling character who told her own story in the style of, you know, say a Becky Sharp kind of character from the past. But I don't think, I think there's so many women writing really great fiction, so many men writing, you know, there's too many books to possibly read. Yes. So I'm not someone who's sort of bemoaning the lack of decent fiction. It's the reverse. I'm always wailing about if I only had time enough to read everything.
The piles,
you know.
Off. Yeah,
exactly. That feeling more.
What are you currently reading?
It is the Richard Yates. I'm rereading Young Hearts Crying. I've also just finished the Jeanette Winterson memoir.
And how did you find that?
Well, I think it was terribly sad and sort of, you know, I mean, it's very stark and...
It's an extraordinary cover, what her mother said to her.
Yes.
The title of the book.
Why Be Happy... We'll have to get it right. Something like, why be happy when you could be normal.
Yeah.
And a lovely photo of her as a little girl.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's quite a painful read in a way. And I do end up reading memoirs. I loved Hilary Mantel's memoir, Giving Up the Ghost, a few years back.
Yeah.
And things like Siri Husvet.
Yes.
I'm very sort of, it's just a pick and mix. I'm probably a perfect person to go in a bookshop and just, you know, rake around. I don't mind what it is or who it is, whether I've heard of them or whether I haven't.
Yeah.
It often is a cover, I'm afraid to say, that attracts me, or work on readers. So I think in that sense, I'm like every other reader. I'm not, I don't really have a system for what I'm reading.
Are you a disciplined writer yourself? Are you someone who locks themselves in the study for 8 hours a day, and or do you do it all, you feel the inspiration and you...
Yes, I'm laughing because I wish I was more disciplined. It would be lovely to have that kind of life. And I've always dreamed that one day, when I was somehow a full-time writer, I would work that way. But I've been a full-time writer for a long time now and it hasn't happened. I'm just someone who, when there is time to write, I can usually get a lot done. So if I have a clear day or a clear 3 days, I'm very focused, I sit down, I love it, it's not a struggle, don't suffer from writer's block. I mean, it's kind of like, yes, this is where I want to be. But the idea of getting those clear days is usually where the struggle is. Other things in life seem to get in the way, and that bit's harder.
Yeah. Do you have plans for your next book? You said before that you're setting it more contemporary.
Yes, I do. I've begun, in fact. I'm about a third of the way through. It's a very strange process for me. I don't really know where it's going. I've got a character, I've got some scenes, I know where it's set. I've sold it. Scepter are going to publish it. So it will come out. I think. And it might be a ghost story. I'm not sure quite where it's going. I mean, it's my 8th novel, so I do have a sense now. I can trust the process a bit, enjoy it, sort of, you know, re-enter a kind of slightly a dream world and go back into a novel, even if I've left it for a few weeks.
Yeah.
So actually, I'm just enjoying it without too much of a clear idea. If you ask me next year, I'll be much more worried. It's due for delivery, you know.
And with the process of writing and that with the editor, do you have a single editor that you've worked with for a long time? Is that relationship key to being with the publisher that you are?
Yes, for me it's absolutely essential. I think I'm quite lucky in today's climate because lots of writer friends, seems to me, don't have the consistency. I've had the same editor, Carol Welsh, for... I think it's 7, all of the novels and one other anthology that I did. And it's fabulously important and sort of relevant to me that it's Carol Welsh, because I feel as if she just really gets me. She's tremendously thorough. yeah, she really has quite a big and significant input. Mm. And yes, I think that's quite a special relationship, actually, when you sort of hand your work over and someone hands it back with all their kind of comments and input, and you don't feel sort of horrified. You think, yes, they're onto something. Yeah. She always is.
Yeah, well, I think that it is crucial, obviously, to have a strong editor or a strong relationship between the two.
But it seems that endlessly it's becoming rarer, it seems. Mm. I don't know if that's true, but that's the impression I get. A little bit harder to have the same editor or for the editor to maybe put the time in that's required. It is quite sort of labour-intensive to read a manuscript that many times.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know if that's true because Carol Welsh still exists and lots of wonderful writers have good editors, so...
And is it always the same kind of time period that your novels take, or can it span between...
No, that's a funny one. They tend to... Do you mean in terms of writing them? How long?
Yeah, there's a kind of process between the
the
flash of inspiration and then...
It seems to have got shorter, despite the fact that I'm often covering longer periods or more difficult research.
Mm.
There's a kind of intensity. I often wonder what's going on, why I'm sort of still bursting out with novels. When will that stop, sort of thing? So that earlier novels, which were light and didn't need, you know, in size, didn't need as much research, seem to take longer because they're your first novel and it's a big deal. But in terms of the period the novel itself covers, I often find that it's the same period. There might be a lot of backstory, but it's usually a 4-month period that the novel actually covers, interestingly. And I've wondered about that, but that's just something I've observed. I don't think it's true in Lucky Bunny, but it's true in others.
Mm. And do you enjoy being nominated for prizes? And do you enjoy the process of going out and publicising your book? I think that's something, coming from as a bookseller, we demand slightly more of authors now to help sell.
I mean, I've signed up to that, if you like. I know that's required and I know readers like it. And also I know that I have gone to author events and loved seeing someone I admire. I mean, when I was young, I remember going to see Margaret Atwood and being really impressed, and Barbara Kingsolver and people like that in my 20s. But sometimes I find it sort of distracting because it seems to me that it's quite a private pleasure reading a novel. It isn't like other art forms. It's not a show or a theatre performance. And I do aim for this very intimate voice, as if I'm just speaking to someone in their own head, which, of course, is how it is, really, between a reader and a writer. And so sometimes the idea then having to be a public figure, and to me, there's a sort of contradiction there. So I don't mind doing it, but I hope it doesn't sort of... I think there's something about reading a book by someone you don't know at all and just being lost in it, really, and know nothing about, even.
So not to confuse the author with the characters,
definitely.
So, slightly contradictory to that, would you like to see it adapted into? Do you have some news? Is there?
I just want to say the BBC has optioned it, and I did meet the screenwriter, which was very exciting. And I did say, can I mention it? You know, how far along? Because you know these things don't always.
Yeah.
And I think it was reasonably far along. It may or may not happen. There's still time for it to happen, but. When they said to me, who could I imagine playing Queenie Dove? I mean, my mind did completely go blank because, to me, she's very real. There isn't an actor who looks like her. It's that vivid to me. And I think then, for authors, it is a strange experience. It's probably a very exciting and nice one if it works well.
Yeah.
But for me, they already sort of live and breathe and move about. Bobby's very real. The Gloria is. Nan. They're all people that sort of populate my mind. Not so much now. I've finished it. But when I was working on it, I think that's what happens.
Yeah. No, it would be great to see.
Good. Well, I would like it. I'm still hoping, yeah.
Yeah.